This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. America has this thing about guns. It's written into the Constitution, and that's part of the promise and the problem. The promise is that we all have a right to own guns. There are many who cherish this right and their guns. Some use them to hunt. Others find comfort in knowing they can defend themselves if necessary. The problem is gun violence has become all too common. What used to shock us has become an everyday event. When mass shootings occur, the dialogue about guns revs up. On one side, there are those who say our fascination with guns and the ownership of guns, too many guns, has made us an outlaw society in which guns have become an all too easy way to solve differences. The other side points to those episodes of violence as making their case to have guns to protect themselves. Each side digs in, nothing changes. But with each violent episode, the dialogue begins anew, always with the same result. What is it about America and guns? Why do so many feel they need so many guns? Why do they find them comforting? Are guns an added measure of protection or something that could actually put a gun owner's life in jeopardy? And if you own a gun, what goes into being a responsible gun owner? We're going to examine all those things with three gun owners from different backgrounds. Erin Woods is an assistant professor of psychology at Catawba College and a gun owner. She is here to speak both as an expert in psychology, but also as an owner, but not for the college. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
You were just on the Takeaway with John Hockenberry.
I was.
That's how we found you. And you responded to a question, a text question from them. What was the question?
The question was, do you own a gun? And if so, why?
And we'll get that answer later on in this program. Okay. Taylor Hayden is owner of Blackstone Shooting Sports. He's a lawyer by trade. He didn't shoot guns, I'm told, until he opened his business about a year ago. Is that true?
That is correct.
Why did you open the business then?
That's a long answer that we'll get to later.
Okay. And you know how this works already, don't you? And many of you know Dan Starks. He's the founder and owner of Starks Training Institute. He teaches self-defense and gun safety and appeared as a self-defense expert for years on local television and on radio as well. Thank you for joining us, Dan. Good morning.
Welcome. Always happy to be here, Mike. It's a subject near and dear to my heart.
Yes, I know. All three of you have experience with guns. The vast number of gun owners in America are law-abiding citizens. Let's put that out on the table right now for people who may not think that. And they have never committed a crime, nor will they ever commit a crime with their guns, the vast majority of them. Many non-owners, we think about the fascination with guns. It's kind of what I said in the beginning. Is this fascination the same as something that one might have for technology or for classic cars, or is something else at work here? I'm not sure who to ask this question of.
I think it's part of our history. I mean, if you go back to the founding fathers, that's how this country was won, with firepower. And it became obviously a national amendment. And over the years, people have looked at that as not only a right and a privilege, but also a way to protect themselves from criminals. Average crime scene is 90 seconds. Average 911 response times 26 minutes. Do the math. You know, as I tell my students, it's their job to make sure that when the cops get to the scene of their crime, that their body's not approaching room temperature. It's really simple.
Is the fascination, or do the people who feel that they need a gun to protect themselves, their family, and their property, do they run the gamut? Are they all walks of life, all socioeconomic levels? Or does it more often occur in areas of a city or a town that we would think would be more dangerous than others?
I've seen about a 45% increase in the number of professional women in the last 24 months, okay? And these are women who have families, children, you know, work downtown or whatever, and they're realizing their vulnerability, and of course a lot of it's driven by what they see in the media. Mm. But it's a mix. What I find really fascinating is I'm having families come to take the class, mothers and fathers and young kids.
How young?
8, 9 years old, okay? Now, an 8 or 9 year old child obviously can't get a concealed carry permit, but the certificate that the child gets has no expiration date on it.
Why is it that an 8-year-old can't drive a car but he can fire a gun?
I think that has to do with the physicality of it. I mean, you put a child in a car, and it's hard for them to see, and I'll understand that. But when they fire a gun, they're not firing a gun by themselves. Every time somebody comes to the range, they have an instructor Velcro to their shoulder to ensure their safety, to improve their skills, et cetera.
If I was right about what you said, what I said in the beginning, Taylor, you did not own a gun until a year ago, and then you opened this shooting range, which is described, as you described, as the most advanced indoor shooting range in the Carolinas. What ignited your interest in guns, and what led you down that path to open that shooting range if you'd never owned a gun before?
Well, as an attorney, I had helped a friend of mine open a shooting range in Nashville, Tennessee. I didn't know really anything about the industry prior to that time. I just was helping him out on the financial side and on the legal side. Mm-hmm. And once I got in there, I realized that there was this unique opportunity in this industry, that the industry was evolving. A lot of the existing ranges are stuck back in the 70s. They're kind of dark and dingy and just not the most pleasant place to be. And so they tend to attract people who have been into guns for a long time. But what we're seeing now is this movement, this shift across the country where these gorgeous facilities are being put into place because the what I call the pie is constantly growing. There's this new level of demand that nobody's ever seen before.
Demand for shooting ranges or demand for guns?
Demand for both, actually. Okay. All right. And it's something I wanted to piggyback on what Dan was saying. Because you were focusing on the Second Amendment a second ago, and you know I'm a lawyer and I love the Second Amendment and all that, and it's really people talk about it as a self-defense thing, whether you're protecting yourself from other citizens or you're protecting yourself from an overreaching government. But what we're seeing is, it, especially at my facility, is a huge increase in the number of recreational shooters, what we would call target shooters. And they come out because it's a fun activity. They come out because you can do it rain or shine because it's indoors. They come out because it's not a big time commitment. You come to the range and you have some fun shooting a game target. We have targets that are tic-tac-toe or targets that are modeled after the battleship game. And the best part about it is that anyone can do it. Kids can do it with the proper supervision. It's gender neutral. It's age neutral, and so you have people who are looking for activities they can do together, and this is the perfect activity because it doesn't matter how old, young, what gender you are. This is something that people can do.
And to piggyback on that thought, it's a challenge. Somebody can come out, whether they've never shot a gun or they've shot a gun forever, and they can get to a certain level of skills. It's like golf. You don't get that every time you go to the golf course. So it's always a challenge, you know, and these people challenge themselves. And it's one of the only sport that you can go out and do and either completely succeed or completely fail, and it has nothing to do with anybody but yourself.
Aaron, you grew up in a rural area. Your father, I think, had a .22 rifle. He was a farmer. Is that right?
Well, actually, my birth father, the one that I inherited my current firearm from, I didn't grow up with him, although he lived in a very rural part of West Virginia. My mother and my stepfather owned a .22 rifle.
Okay, and the rifle was described as being for farm purposes. What does that mean, shooting varmints?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Pretty much. Never, ever to be used in any format with another human being.
Right.
Like it was never even considered a defense mechanism against. I mean, we still don't know where the key is to the house is that I grew up in.
Okay, so that gun was simply part of the house. It was, you know, I'm sure you didn't obsess about it. It wasn't discussed very much. You inherited a .38 upon the death of your birth father, and up till then, you, as I understand this, had not been a gun owner.
No, I had intermittently shot guns, other people's guns, when we were doing target shooting at various places. But now this is the first gun that I've owned.
So you had no interest in this really until it came to you through an inheritance.
Well, that's not technically true because I have a son, And when his father and I were together and we were living together, he is a gun proponent and enthusiast. And so we had many, many discussions about the role that firearms would play in the home that we shared and that my son was born into. We got to the point where he chose the firearm that he was most comfortable with because his purposes for having it were to defend the house and his family. So we agreed that he could maintain that one in that home and then keep the rest somewhere else.
Speak to me as a psychologist. Mm-hmm. Where does that fear the feeling of the need for a weapon to defend your house, property, and family come from? Is it the media? Are we stirring up the fires of fear around the country?
So it's hard for me to disconflate, if I might use that made-up term, the issue of the fear from the media and then this ongoing fear that I think is part of the concern about the slippery slope of the retraction or the amendment of the Second Amendment. I really am concerned. I've been reading a lot about this in the last couple weeks. I'm really concerned that there are many people who are not gun owners who believe that the sole purpose for people to own guns or the motivation behind it is fear. I do believe that what I like to call the 24-hour entertainment news cycle does put out repeated exposure to gun-associated violence. But at the same time, I mean, from the perspective of a psychologist, if you see a picture or hear a story one time, you can process it that one time or go back to it intermittently. But if every station that you turn to and every conversation in the grocery store line is about a mass shooting or is about a tragedy that's occurred that's been associated with firearms, we are not capable unless we try really hard, and you need practice in doing this, of understanding that repeated exposure doesn't mean that it's happened that many times.
It's interesting what she's saying because I was just reading a Pew Research study that if you survey Americans and ask them how much gun violence has gone up since 1993, that the majority of people think that it has gone up. And in reality, it's decreased by 75%.
Really? Because there is a mass shooting in this country, and that means three or more people have died because of gun violence every single week.
And Mike,
did that happen in 1983? I don't think so.
I blame a lot of that on the insistence of having gun-free zones. As far as I'm concerned, a gun-free zone is an invitation for a lunatic to go have fun. We designate places where people are not allowed to defend themselves. And if you look at most of the mass shootings since 1960, the majority have taken that place in gun-free zones. Why? Because there's nobody who can resist it. If you look at the Aurora, Colorado shooting, okay, that famous shooting, two things in that shooting. That kid's psychiatrist knew what he was going to do. He had told his psychiatrist. HIPAA laws prevented the psychiatrist from informing the security police, the campus police. The theater that he went to was not the closest theater to his home. He bypassed seven theaters that all had permits for concealed carry. It was the first gun-free zone.
Which leads to a question. Do law-abiding citizens carrying guns, concealed or otherwise, actually make us safer? We'll get an answer to that from our three guests when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Opera Carolina celebrating the year of William Shakespeare with performances of Romeo and Juliet on January 24th, 28th, and 30th. Info at 704-372-1000 or online at operacarolina.org. And Theater Charlotte presenting The Importance of Being Earnest, an Oscar Wilde comedy. Two bachelors lead double lives to gain the attention of a woman they both desire. That's Friday through February 7th. Tickets at carolinatix.org. A lot of us are addicted and we don't even know it. Not to drugs, but to our screens, to being connected, to being always on and available. You know, it's too easy to just sit out there and check email and Facebook and things like that. We've allowed technology to control our lives. It's not healthy. And tomorrow at 9 on this program, we learn how to digitally detox. Join us.
Falling oil prices don't just affect what you pay at the pump for your car. They also make jet fuel cheaper, and that's turning into more affordable flights for consumers.
Airfares are trending down, as we're seeing about 14 or 15% lower this year than we have in the past.
Looking to get away? Why now may be the time to book that trip. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon from 4 till 6:30 on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about gun ownership. We want to hear from you. What does responsible gun ownership mean to you? You can reach us through Facebook or Twitter at WFAE, or you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Aaron Woods with us, a psychologist and a gun owner. Taylor Hayden is the owner of Blackstone Shooting Sports, and Dan Starks is founder and owner of the Starks Training Institute. Dan mentioned a second ago that the reason for the increase, I guess, in gun-related violence or certainly mass shootings is that they mostly occur, and this is probably true, in gun-free zones, places you're not permitted to carry a gun, or you're not allowed on the premises if you have a gun. And if you had a gun, you could have defended yourself against the shooter. At least that's the theory. So let me ask the three of you who are gun owners. Does a person carrying a gun, concealed or otherwise, make us all safer? If you have a gun in a restaurant, a gun in a movie theater, if you own a gun and you carry it with you to your child's school, if you're a teacher in that school, does that make the people in that school safer?
My perspective is that with all due respect to the people who have taken the time and the energy and to my co-guests here and their efforts at their owned organizations, most people do not take the time and the effort to practice and learn about the mechanisms and the skills associated with the level of adeptness that one needs to be functional in those situations. And so for the most part, I don't feel like more people with guns, like more good guys with guns are going to stop bad guys, because it's not malicious. It's just that we have a tendency to be overly confident with a minimum level of exposure to any particular topic. And guns make people feel powerful. And so if you add in the level of power that a person might feel because they are carrying a gun, with overconfidence that's associated with not enough practice. I mean, I've said this before. The more we learn about something, the more we learn that we don't know about it. Mm. That's one of the things I tell my students constantly. When I got my bachelor's, I thought I would know so much. When I got my master's, I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll learn something. And when I got my terminal degree, I realized, oh my gosh, I know so little. And I think the conversation around what it means to be a responsible gun owner does not commonly have that element within it, which is that you need to continue to come back, continue to practice, and be honest about your weaknesses, and let's work on that.
Well, Dan, you run a course on this. You train people how to use guns, and you train people how to defend themselves with and without a firearm. I have taken your course. Years ago, I took your course because I was interested in seeing exactly what goes on and what the tenets of responsible gun ownership are, because I quite frankly didn't understand it, and I still have trouble understanding it today. But do you think the average person who owns a gun is trained enough in its use? And do they train themselves enough? Do they go back and practice at a shooting range enough to be adept at it and to use it safely?
I think the safety issue is addressed in the concealed carry course, because that's one of the tenets. If you're going to get a certificate, you got to pass a certain modicum of safety. But as far as somebody carrying a gun for self-defense, you really need to become familiar with it. I liken it to driving a car. If you're driving down the street and all of a sudden the guy in front of you slams on his brakes, you don't have to think how to use your brake. You use it automatically. Mm-hmm. If you're walking down the street and somebody decides to attack you, you don't have time to think how to make your firearm work. It has to become automatic. And I stress to my students to take their firearm, whatever it is that they're going to carry, take it home and sit in a room and every day pick it up and set it down. Pick it up and set it down. Switch hands. Do it till you want to get sick. That way at least you become comfortable with it and familiar. And it's a beginning of a step.
Do most gun owners want, do they see a need for being trained and certified, or do they feel that they've done enough by buying the gun, buying a gun safe to put the gun in so the kids can't get to it, and they've done their part? Do they want the training? Do they want the certification?
Well, I mean, I've had over 100 people come through the concealed carry class in January, so I would say they want it, and they want it because it makes it legal for them, okay? The concealed carry certificate actually does a lot for a person besides carrying a gun.
But if you don't want the concealed carry certificate, if you just want to have a gun in the house for your protection in the home, you don't have to have that certification.
No, you don't. And
should you, and should they want it, and do they want it in those situations?
I think people absolutely should have training in it. I mean, not just in how the mechanics of the firearm, but the laws behind the use of force and all of that stuff.
I mean, we all have to get driver's licenses to operate a motor vehicle. Why shouldn't we have to get certification to own a gun?
Well, I think that crosses barriers of ethnicity and mental capacity and stuff. And I think there's a certain group of people out there that think, well, I can't pass the test because I can't. I mean, I had a gentleman who came and took my class last week who was legally blind.
Should he own a gun?
Absolutely.
Why?
Because he lives in an apartment by himself, and he can see. He just can't see to drive. And if he has to be able to defend himself, again, you go back to the 911, but you know they're going to come to the scene of the crime.
You want to chime in on this, Taylor?
Yeah, I did have a couple thoughts on that. In terms of how people training, buying guns, and feeling the need to train, we've found that a huge number of the people who come and shop in our store will then go on to train with our trainers, whether one-on-one or they're coming to our classes. Especially the people who are the most likely to train from our year of being in business have been the women who buy guns. Women are the fastest growing segment of this industry by far, and they also are less likely to be comfortable right away with a firearm, which is why we find that women tend to be better shots because they take their time and they're much more deliberate as they learn what they're doing.
You're the lawyer here. Would mandated training for those who buy a firearm be unconstitutional?
I mean, that's a really broad question. My general view, which I'm a pretty strict reader of the Constitution, is yes, it would. I don't think you could do that.
And the reason I asked the question is I went to Dan's class. This is years ago, 20 years ago probably, 15 years ago. And a couple of things still stick with me. And a lot of the people there, like myself, were beginners.
Sure.
They had never touched a gun in their lives. And you had several guns there, unloaded, and you let them pick them up. And they picked them up incorrectly. And the first thing that came that you said is never put your finger on the trigger unless you intend to pull it. Second thing I remember is never point a gun at anything you don't plan to fire at.
Right.
And people were pointing it all over the room with their finger on the trigger. Now, that seems basic 101 to me. That seems
life-saving. Are you sure those weren't training guns? Because I don't allow any firearms.
Well, maybe they were. I don't know. But it was clear that they were not dangerous. But,
right.
But people didn't know that going into it. So that seems 101. That seems life-saving to me.
Yeah. I mean, we do not allow live ammunition, firearms of any sorts in the classroom. We have training weapons, but we now have people work one-on-one with people and showing that grip and a stance, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, we have toned that down a little bit and tuned it up.
But if you didn't, if I hadn't gone to that class and I hadn't witnessed your admonition of these people as they picked up these guns, I wouldn't have known the difference. I mean, the only gun I'd ever touched was a toy.
Sure.
And with a toy, you pull the trigger. I mean, right. That's what you do.
That's right.
It never occurred to me that you don't point at something if you don't intend to fire the gun.
Right.
For instance. So it seems to me that that kind of training should be part and parcel of being a responsible gun owner, don't you think?
I have to say that the word responsible, while it seems like an appropriate term, has taken on some unfortunate associations. And I think that this comes from a section of gun owners, perhaps gun owners that have owned guns for many years, perhaps before it became, no pun intended, but a firestorm around the Second Amendment and gun violence. I think it's being associated with the slippery slope that I've commented on before. And those people, perhaps, I'm hypothesizing here, those people are the people that if they have attended training, it was a long time ago, and they're not interested in continuing the training, they have their gun, they have their firearms, that's their right, and any sort of requirement for them to do anything associated with their gun ownership is stepping on their rights as a citizen. And the language that I've seen more recently about the progressive gun owner, the groups that Dan and Taylor are talking about seeing more of in their classes, these are people who are more familiar with the idea of training with any sort of tool. And also this idea that it is now like a recreational or entertainment associated process as opposed to enthusiasts or collectors, as opposed to people who are more focused on safety and defense. I don't think we had all of these different groups of people interested in owning firearms.
Whenever we have a mass shooting, we open this debate about whether we should have guns and the Second Amendment allows us to have guns and should we change the Second Amendment. What is it that non-gun owners don't understand about gun owners? What is it that people who say we should not allow guns in this country, think they should allow them?
I think a lot of people think that firearms make people evil. And I demonstrate in my class, if you set a gun down, loaded it up, cocked the hammer, walked away from it, 10 years from now, the gun would still be there. It wouldn't go bang. So when you put it in the hands of somebody, that it becomes a problem. And then if you put it in the hands of somebody who has an evil intent, it becomes a greater problem. It gives that person, it makes that person greater to or equal than the other person. And that's something that, as a psychologist, you understand that's a mental thing. You know, they don't have a problem over in England with firearms now because they took them away. Now they have a problem with knives. The people who are committing crimes are using knives instead of guns. So that you can't control the problem by controlling the mechanics.
Except that we have more firearm killings in this country than any other nation in the world.
Right. Well, we are also probably bigger than any other single nation in this world with the liberal ability. I mean, Australia, they confiscated all the people's firearms and destroyed them. And a lot of the countries have done that.
And Australia is an interesting case because even after doing that, the murder rate in that country stayed flat. It did not decrease it. It didn't increase it,
right.
But it didn't decrease
it. So you would disagree with the statement. You would agree with the statement, guns don't kill people, people kill people.
Can I also add one of the things that that I have seen that I think – people who don't own guns and don't want to own guns, they think that gun owners own guns out of the emotion of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And when I talk to my students about the role that emotions have in decision making, we have a strong preference in this and other, with all due respect to my colleagues here in the studio and elsewhere, a patriarchal expectation that people who use emotions in decision-making are making poor decisions. So we say, you really want to go to a rational person. You want to go to somebody who's not employing emotion in their decision-making when you're going to make a big decision. But In this particular situation, I don't experience an emotion of fear when I think about not having my gun. I want to get my concealed carry permit because I want training, not because I actually want to carry my gun around. And I've read and heard people say I'm made very uncomfortable when I see somebody open carrying their firearm. It makes the whole situation seem more dangerous. But that is the perspective of the person or the people looking at this gun and being afraid of it. And my perspective is I have a responsibility to be as capable in any unfortunate circumstance of using any of the tools that are there for me. So although I probably will never buy a 5-speed again, you can bet that I will maintain my ability to drive a stick shift. Although I don't know that I'll ever own a motorcycle, you can bet that I am working on learning how to drive a motorcycle. These are like, I just want to be able to be prepared, and not because I'm scared, but because I have a level of expectation for myself.
The biggest part of the problem in America is that guns fall into the hands of the wrong people, the bad guys, people who are either mentally unstable or have evil intent or want to commit a crime using a gun. Have you heard any logical proposal that would also match with the Second Amendment that might change that?
Well, the fundamental problem with gun regulation is the problem that we've experienced with lots of things we want to regulate over time. And then it's just about impossible to do. We can put all of the restrictions we want on, but people are going to find a way. If it's something people want, they're going to get it. Recently, there's a company, actually a nonprofit organization called Defense Distributed that came up with their Wiki Weapon Project. And so they made 3D printable guns. They came up with plans for 3D printable guns and a home CNC machine where you could CNC your own lower receiver, which is the part of an AR-15 that's called the gun. And their stated goal, one of them, was to prove the futility of government regulations on this subject. There's guns out there. The genie is out of the bottle. You can't stuff it back in, and people will find a way. The guns are a super simple machine. It's not like you need an engineering degree to make one. It is such a simple piece of equipment. I don't think there's any significant regulation they will do that would have the impact that they want to see.
Because we've been talking about training and understanding what it means to be a responsible gun owner, and the people who are not responsible gun owners are the problem, and not average citizens. These are people who shouldn't have guns. Among them, people who are mentally unstable. They shouldn't have guns.
It may seem to be an extremely simple solution, but it's a criminal solution. And I look at it this way. If a felon gets caught with a gun, they're committing a felony. Mm-hmm. But we don't really punish them. I've dealt with more victims of crime who the guy was out of jail after 2 years instead of 20 years. If we made it simple that a felon caught with a firearm would spend 25 years in jail, and I'm talking 25 years, not 23, not 21, and that would be the start. The second thing would be if a felon were used to commit a gun in the commission of a crime, that felon would come out of jail in a bag or a box. Number three, if somebody kill somebody with a firearm, we have a death penalty. I know it's brutal, but I think if we actually did that for a while, and all of a sudden these guys were going, wait a minute, I don't want to be caught with one of those, because if I'm caught with it, I'm going to go to jail
for
25
years. But then, using a previous argument in this hour, wouldn't people just then resort to using knives?
Possibly so.
Because the laws would be geared toward
or baseball
guns.
Bats or fry pans.
Exactly. Right. So,
yes.
All right. I'll share with you some things that have come in as we've been talking from listeners when we come back from the break, but we got to take the break. I hear the music playing. And we'll come right back with more. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Queen City Audio, Video, and Appliances, purveyors of premium appliances since 1952, including the new Obsidian Interior Refrigerator from Jennair, designed to showcase food like never before. Details at queencityonline.com. And High Point University, a liberal arts-based institution providing students a college experience grounded in holistic education, experiential learning, and values-based living. Details at highpoint.com. edu. The Supreme Court takes up President Obama's immigration plan that would shield more than 4 million people for deportation. They'll be talking about that on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock with guest host Susan Page. If you'd like to join our conversation, jump in. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. I'm sure you have things to say, and we are coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Yet another of the world's great cities has come under attack. This time it's Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
Governor McCrory vetoed the bill, saying it doesn't protect workers who uncover criminal activity. Lawmakers overrode his veto.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about gun ownership, gun safety, gun responsible gun ownership, and all the conversations that swirl around guns and their use in our society with Erin Wood, a psychologist from Catawba College, but she's not here to talk on the college's behalf. She's here to talk on her own behalf, and she's thought a lot about this. She is a gun owner. Taylor Hayden owns Blackstone Shooting Sports, and Dan Stark is the founder and owner of Stark's Training Institute. Let me share with you some things that have come in while we've been talking. We asked the question what you think constitutes responsible gun ownership. Jim emails, as a law enforcement officer with 25 years of combined military and law enforcement experience, I have witnessed many instances where highly trained people have dangerously mishandled firearms. I have no confidence armed citizens have adequate training or the judgment to safely carry firearms in public. Any reaction to that?
It's kind of, I think one of the problems with the way this debate is handled a lot is that people who want to exercise the right that's granted to them under the Second Amendment are defending themselves and saying that the world will be safer with us carrying or anything along those lines. You need to prove that there's a reason to do it. You need to prove that there's a reason to do the very thing that you are given the right by our Constitution to do.
But there are laws governing the use of a firearm, even in self-defense.
Oh, absolutely. As I tell my students, you know, you take a gun out and pull the trigger, that bullet's going to hit something. Mm-hmm. And whatever it hits is linked directly to your assets and possibly your freedom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, average range of a handgun bullet's mile and a half.
You talked about emotions entering into this. And if you have a firearm and you're emotional, it's a split-second decision that you cannot take back.
But I would also suggest that we have plenty of evidence from neuroscience that when the parts of the brain that oversee emotional regulation are made dysfunctional, if they're lesioned, those people become unable to make even the most simple decisions. So the assumption that somebody would misuse a firearm if they are emotional as opposed to appropriately use a firearm if they are not is far oversimplified. That's not the way it works. The issue is, and with all due respect to what your the contributor Jim just said, perhaps it's not the right sort of training. I mean, on the number that gets thrown around a lot is we don't become an expert in anything until we've had 10,000 hours.
Right.
10,000 hours.
Which gets back to my question. Shouldn't people who there is training involved with concealed carry, but shouldn't that be ongoing training? Shouldn't it require that you spend some time once a month or once a week or whatever the interval is in a shooting range to keep your skills up?
Well, I would.
You would like
I would,
that
I would love that. We have memberships available.
But shouldn't that be part of it? If you need 10,000 hours of training.
Well, the operative word there, Mike, is training. Mm-hmm. Picking up a gun and pointing it at a paper target and pulling the trigger is not training. That's shooting a handgun. You could be reinforcing a mistake over and over and over again, so it's almost inoperable to change it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're going to have training, you really need hands-on training with somebody who understands the dynamic.
You need a coach.
Exactly right. And the problem with that, bottom line, is comes down to money. I mean, I offer it. I think, you know, you may offer it. But most people don't feel the need for it.
Well, she just said 10,000 hours, and she's the psychologist. And you have a police officer on the other end of this email who said, I don't trust anybody with a gun out there because they're not sufficiently trained. If you're going to have concealed carry permits and training is required for that, why can't we mandate, Second Amendment or not, why can't we mandate, just like an airline pilot, they have to fly a plane every once in a while or they lose their ability to fly the plane. They can't get a license.
But they don't have... They don't have a constitutionally granted right to fly a plane.
I was thinking about nobody questions that a firearm is a deadly weapon, right? And nobody's questioning the fact that it's not going to crawl up off the table right. And shoot someone by itself.
Right, exactly.
But nobody's granting people the constitutional right to drive cars. But we set a level of expectation that people who are going to have access to deadly things.
The Second Amendment says you have a right to bear arms. What does that mean?
I think that if you look back at the papers from the founders, I think the two primary – the real main purpose for it was to protect the militia, to protect yourself from the government.
But the phrase, the right to bear arms, does that mean a right to own them or does it mean the right to pick it up and use it?
Well, I don't think ownership really comes into that, Mike, as much as the end use of it. I mean, if I go take a gun that isn't mine and I shoot somebody, the end result is the same. It has nothing to do with ownership.
Amy emails, I'm a gun owner, and I fully believe that gun ownership is my right, but I'm sick and tired of this country not discussing the level of fear that prevents common sense measures. It is possible to track ammunition sales and even ID where bullets were sold, but we won't allow it. Responsible ownership is also helping making it safer for others and yourself. And that leads to something that I know that you want to talk about, Aaron, because you said that in notes that I got from you that that you don't understand why we aren't interested in smart gun technology.
Well, so since my comments on the takeaway, I've gotten a lot of people have shared different sources with me. And I believe that eventually the technology will be sufficiently capable
mm-hmm.
at
right
this
now,
time.
Not.
But that's with any technology, medical technology, vehicular technology.
Smart gun technology, for people who don't know, would not allow you to fire a gun that is not yours. When you get your new gun, you would there's some sensor on the trigger that recognizes you, and you can pull the trigger, but nobody else could. So if you dropped the gun in the face of a criminal and they picked it up and pointed and pulled the trigger, it would not fire. Now, if the gun technology that allows that to happen doesn't work any better than the fingerprint recognition on my smartphone, I wouldn't want it either because mm-hmm. it wouldn't work 90% of the time.
And it's fairly cost prohibitive.
Okay.
I mean, it'd be extremely
But when Smith and Wesson tried this, they were kind of blackballed.
Yes.
Because they tried something different.
Right. Anytime the firearm industry bows to, legislation, the gun owners, the people who support these people, throw up their arms.
But wouldn't it be in the best interest of responsible gun owners to be on board with new technologies that might actually make things safer?
Well, I think a good parallel for this is the seatbelt debate of the early 80s. Seatbelts have made cars safer, but the fear at the time, people didn't want them in their cars. They were right. mad at their legislatures for supporting the seatbelt regulations. They thought that they were going to get stuck in their car and they were going to die in a fire if there was an accident. People don't like added regulations that they don't think are in their best interests.
And that's not going to address the other problem, Mike. There's over 300 million firearms in this country right now.
Mm-hmm.
So if you make smart gun technology, that's not going to have any outcome, any real influence on the criminal end of it. Yes, it might provide mom and dad to go out and buy a gun that makes a gun to safe in their home, but I don't think it's going to have a lick of...
But isn't the best defense a good offense? Recently, President Obama announced that in the face of congressional inaction, he would use his executive powers to tighten federal controls on who can legally obtain a gun. He wants anybody in the business of selling firearms, either a gun store or a gun show or over the internet, to get a license to do so and conduct background checks. He wants the ATF to make sure that the dealers who ship firearms notify law enforcement if their guns are lost or stolen in transit. He wants to remove barriers in order to enable states to report relevant information about people prohibited from possessing a gun for mental health reasons. He wants to review the availability of smart gun technology. This has presidential candidates on the Republican side of the aisle apoplectic, as it does the NRA and other people. It seems to me that these 60, I think two-thirds of the American people agree with what the president has proposed here.
Well, a lot of that is already done.
Yeah, a lot of it's already – that's already – the law is –
Then why is everybody up in arms about it?
Lack of knowledge. People who don't understand firearms don't understand the regulation going into firearms. You cannot buy or sell or transport a firearm legally without having – it go through a federally licensed firearms dealer. Now, you go to a gun show and you buy a gun from a dealer at a gun show, he has to fill out the paperwork.
Yeah, but there's video. I've seen it on television of people going to gun shows and they meet somebody in the gun show who has a gun in the car that he's willing to sell off the books, and they do it.
Well, that's a different thing altogether. That's not a licensed dealer. That's a private sale is what you're talking about.
That's the only true expansion
right
here, is that – so already anybody in the business, quote unquote, that's the legal language, is supposed to have their FFL and comply with all the background checks that go with being a licensed dealer. The question is what the president was saying in that – what is it? It's not an executive order. It was an executive
action
or whatever. What he was saying was, you guys are supposed to be regulating people in the business, and you need to be looking closely at what in the business means and making your regulations more clear as to what that was. That was kind of the extent of it, and I'm okay with that as a licensed dealer. We found that people get nervous in private transfers because they're wondering what their liability is, and so we even will facilitate transfers.
Should certain people be unable to buy a gun?
Oh, absolutely. It's like certain people should be unable to drive a car when you got somebody who's had 10, 12 DUIs.
Does the NRA agree with you on that?
I don't know if the NRA would agree with that.
Why do they have so much power in this discussion when there are so many more gun owners who are not members of the NRA?
They're the largest lobbying organization in the world. But you see, I look at it this way. If you made it difficult for people, let's just say I wanted to sell you a handgun. I'm a private seller. You're a private buyer. You and I go over to Larry Hyatt's. On paper, I sell Larry Hyatt the gun. So he puts it through his federal license fire. On paper, Larry Hyatt sells you the gun.
Mm-hmm.
You and I transfer the money. So there's a record of that.
Okay. How many people go through that exercise?
They don't. I tell my students they're fools not to. Because if you sell somebody a gun privately and then the gun is stolen from their house, the ATF's coming to your front door because that's where they're going to track it.
If the gun is registered
in the
first place.
Well, if the gun was sold at some point in time.
Chris on Facebook, suicide is the leading cause of death from firearms. This is a public health issue. We become obsessed with the rare mass shootings and respond in fear when we buy guns without training. More guns alone won't solve either of these issues.
Does Chris believe that fewer guns would prevent those people from committing suicide?
There is evidence to suggest that firearms are the main method of suicide commission because it's fast. You don't have to sit around and plan, how you're going to hang yourself or what bridge you're going to throw yourself off of. So this falls within the realm of crimes of passion. But I also have to say, I am concerned about the continued suggestion that the only people who commit violent illegal acts with guns are people who are mentally ill. Just because you're violent doesn't mean you're mentally ill. And most people who are mentally ill are not violent. And so, yes, we need to work on our mental health care system in this country, but this is not the reason why. And there are many ways to decide and enact a plan to be violent using any number of weapons that has nothing to do with mental disability or some sort of issue of emotional regulation control. I want to be really clear about that because, for me, that's one of the main slippery slopes here. And this idea that we're going to share information across state lines about people's mental health, we don't even know what the threshold is. How many different mental disorders are there? And in what cases do we assume that one type of mental disorder suddenly precludes that person from being violent with a gun, and yet there are plenty of people who will never receive a mental health diagnosis that are far more likely to be violent with guns.
I want to point out to people who are just joining us that Erin is both a gun owner and a psychologist, so she has her bona fides there for talking about things like that. You have a nine-lane tactical training bay in your shooting range designed for advanced law enforcement and for civilian training. Why do civilians need to be trained on the use of tactical weapons?
Well, it's not necessarily the use of tactical weapons. The term tactical bay refers to the fact that you can move the full length of the bay. We have steel plating all the way down. So most of our bays are set up as a static bay, which means they were designed on the expectation that the shooter is always standing in the same position, so you don't have to have steel all the way across the roof. So by tactical bay, it means that we can set up special shoots, again, with a focus on – it's not necessarily – so we might do some tactical training that is advanced, low light, stuff like that. But it's also so that the shooter can move up and down the full length and you can run more entertaining competitions.
Should we be concerned that some people in this country, some civilians in this country, own AK-47s and assault rifles that were designed to be used by the military – to kill people in a war situation?
Well, how would you define an assault rifle, Mike?
I'm not sure.
Because that term is
High velocity, rapid fire, high capacity magazine.
Can I interject on that?
Very
because
quickly.
I asked that in my class. I take a 5-shot 38 caliber revolver and I take a fully automatic machine gun. One's called an assault weapon. No, they're both called assault weapons.
Quick.
It's what the purpose of it is done, not the mechanics of it.
Yeah, but if you can go, that's far more than bang, bang, bang. We have to stop. We're out of time. Sorry. Dan Starks, owner and founder of Starks Training Institute. Taylor Hayden, owner of Blackstone Shooting Sports. Erin Wood, a psychologist and a gun owner. Thank you for the hour. Very interesting.